Do you remember how we first met on the internet?
Yeah, I do remember how we met on the internet. Do you remember how we met on the internet?
No, because at this point, anything that happened in the days that Twitter was good and blogs made money and like all the things that were true at the time, it all seems like such ancient history that it seems like it's always been there.
Right.
And that suddenly something is different about it.
I remember how we met on the internet because it was one of the defining good internet before the bad times type of interactions that has propelled me to keep using all of these pieces of the internet that maybe don't work quite as well anymore, because I remember when they did work. And the answer to that question, how we met, is we met on Twitter.
Sure.
I had begun either following you or following the publication you worked for, Read Write Web, which is a very challenging thing to say.
I'm so glad I don't have to say that anymore.
Yeah. But you had posted something about doing a Google Hangout, which, man, that really dates the whole thing too, doesn't it?
Uh-huh.
About Pocket and reading things later, Instapaper, all of that stuff, which, again, dates the conversation perfectly. And I had some free time that day, asked if I could join the Hangout, and that was really probably the first real interaction that you and I had. And that was in 2012,
really?
I think. Yeah.
The year sounds right. So I remember that show. We were on a group video chat. That was so insane that we would do that show, that they let me do that show. To just like turn on the streaming live group call and call people and talk about
stuff
and publish that video immediately.
When you describe it that way, that sounds great. That sounds like the future.
Doesn't it?
You know? Like when I think about what a publication should be doing.
It was so fun.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. Yeah. Let's all have a live video call right now where we talk about the things that you care about. That was a really fun idea. And it's sad to me that that was a 2012 idea and somehow not a 2018 idea.
Well, there's a few things that have changed since then about real-time conversation as an online medium.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was listening to lots of podcasts already at that time, I feel like. Chronologically, it had to be. Like, my first podcast that I listened to regularly, I knew what they were. I had iTunes and iPods and stuff and knew that they were available. But when Back to Work started, I heard about it on a blog, someone's blog, don't remember whose. And so I've been listening to podcasts since then. And that's definitely the kind of mood that I was going for when I realized we could make a video show.
Mm-hmm.
But still, podcasting was way nerdier than it is now. And it found its niche in people's life in the last, I don't know, couple of years. Serial happened. You know, there were all these podcasts that made podcasts into a contemporary medium. And I think what happened to the way people relate to talking to each other online is that this is the best form for it. Conversations should be audio only. They can come with you and you can put them on for a few minutes at a time whenever you're doing whatever you're doing. And like, that's starting to fit into people's lives. And I was thinking about us doing this and realized that starting a podcast feels more like joining Twitter in the first place did to me, like emotionally, than doing a show the way that doing that web video show felt. Or the way I thought about it in the abstract is like a project, as something that I wanted to create and put out in the world. What we're doing right now feels a lot more like having a go at a kind of online relationship that is the way to have authentic online interactions, which is what Twitter felt like when I got into it.
Yeah, and somewhere over the way that was lost, right? I don't know how many people are having...
On Twitter, you mean?
Yeah, good friendships, good little communiques on Twitter or really any other social media platform. I guess a part of that is when a platform grows, you lose that a little bit. Because even though it was never true, it did feel kind of like back in 2012 that I could have known basically everybody on Twitter. And that obviously wasn't real. There was many more people than I could have ever followed at that time. But it felt so small in a way that it just doesn't anymore. And I think when something feels small, you treat it small mentally. in a good way, mm-hmm. where you think of it as something that you can kind of touch more. You know, there were plenty of people that I followed back then that were people that I didn't know in real life and that I never thought that I would know in real life, but I probably felt more like I could send them a message and they would see it than I do today on Twitter, where if I follow some celebrity or somebody I look up to a lot, I have basically no space in my mind where I think, if I send them a message, they'll probably see this, or they might even respond, where maybe back in 2012 I did. So when you feel like the platform is yours a bit, you have some ownership that you don't when the platform grows. And maybe that's a cool thing about podcasting, is that it does feel like you're owning your slice of the podcasting world. I mean, is there anywhere that you feel like you can have that kind of friendship online anymore, in any social network, any platform?
Well, no. I would say that this is it. And also something else that occurred to me in response to your question is, when I described the rise of podcasting a minute ago, I described it in terms of the obvious things, the things that were obvious 5 years ago when podcasting started to take off, which is that, like, the great thing about it is you can put it in your pocket and take it with you and do the laundry and go to the grocery store or whatever. But maybe it tracks more closely to the loss of intimacy online, the rise of people listening to podcasts and doing podcasts. Like, I'm sure the trend line is pretty parallel there with the number of podcasts as well as the number of people listening to podcasts. And maybe it's not surprising. It's definitely not surprising, and maybe it's the better explanation that as intimacy has been lost online and people are filling that gap with the intimacy of listening to people having a real conversation. And, you know, I feel like this has been pretty extreme for you. For me, the loss of this relationship, that online kind of relationship, has been very extreme, and I felt it tremendously, and it's been very painful. And to have it finally get to the point of wanting to start regularly podcasting with one person feels like a kind of therapy for that loss to me.
So I want to know about that history, because I'm curious. You know, I only have my perspective, like kind of the stuff that I have seen from my vantage point, but I've never really like heard it necessarily from you. Can you kind of give me a history of internet, John? Like, what does that look like? How did you kind of even get so deeply embedded in the web to begin with?
Yeah, it goes back so much further than I usually talk about, actually. Mm-hmm. It goes all the way back to the days of making Angel Fire pages for your non-existent punk band on the computer lab at school.
Right.
I guess I was in like sixth or seventh grade when I started doing that. But the first thing I ever did online that counts maybe as an adult pursuit of the dream of the web, in 2002 or 2003, when a couple high school friends of mine and I started this group blog where we were writing about politics, and we were using our real first names, but we weren't disclosing our last names or our ages. And when we started to get comments and trackbacks, all of those great old measures of what would now be called engagement, it started to kind of freak me out. It was overwhelming how cool it was that not only could I express those kinds of opinions and be taken seriously, but that I could express them and be taken seriously by people around the world that I didn't know. And I was in high school. I learned to write probably at that time. I certainly learned the hypertext form of writing, the article length thing that's usually in response to something that I read online and full of links. And I was using RSS. It was probably Google Reader. I can't remember when Google Reader came out. And I guess it was really when I started seeing links to stuff that I wrote in stuff that I read in my RSS feed that it really started to happen for me, that I started to feel like I was participating in something.
Yeah.
College was kind of a dark age for me on the internet. I was involved enough in worldly affairs that I wasn't really doing that so much. But I had these few, like, Blogger or WordPress false starts where I would start some enigmatic, angsty, anonymous thing where I would write very college types of screeds and essays. And like, I don't even remember the usernames or URLs for those things anymore, but I'm sure they're still floating around somewhere. And it was not what I was studying. I was studying music. So I was using computers a lot, always have used computers a lot. Maybe I should have gone back that far. I mean, all of my engagement with the web was just an extension of my engagement with the Macintosh, which was, you know, where my entire imagination was founded on that platform.
Right.
It goes back to the earliest years of playing. So it became something that I explored, and I explored every nook and cranny of the computer on my desk, and then suddenly had the ability to explore out into the rest of the world beyond my other computers, beyond my computer. So I guess that's how it happened. It wasn't until after college that I sort of realized that there was an economy out there. Out of college, I went into an AmeriCorps program in Providence, where I went to school, that was a desk job. And I had no idea what I was going to do for a career, but there was this, you know, 1 year service opportunity. So I took it, and it involved sitting at a desk and doing computer stuff all day. And I wasn't the best employee in the world at this job, but at the same time, I very quickly used up the amount of useful work I could do and just waited for email, basically. And I didn't want to like do other stuff on the clock, but like I said, I tried. And so that was the first time I ever really had long expanses of browsing around on the internet looking for stuff. And that's when I found that there was this burgeoning world of not just blogs, which I had still been reading the whole time and discovering others through the links in those blogs that I was reading, but applications. Like there were, in 2009, Twitter existed. I'd been on Facebook since college, but like, I mean, I thought of that as basically, you know, a communication method with my friends. I didn't even think of it as the open internet, really. And it almost wasn't.
Yeah, it really wasn't. There was no such thing as a public post at that time. So if people weren't your friends, then
right,
your stuff wasn't being seen by anyone else, really.
And I didn't want it to be either. Like, I still treated my Facebook presence as private. I mean, I always did that, like through as of January 1st when I shut down my account this year. But like, obviously there was the whole public page thing, and I've been admins of big public Facebook pages for a long time, so it hasn't really felt like that. But it was the Ruby on Rails web app era. So there were startups, and I found this one that really appealed to my sensibilities, called NewsTrust, newstrust.net, which I think has finally gone away. And it was this nonprofit, 2 or 3 person organization. The interface to NewsTrust was you went to newstrust.net and you had this front page. It looked like a newspaper front page. And it had all these stories, and they were clearly sorted by some kind of algorithm, but they were rated with qualities that you could see on the front page for their journalistic merits, for their fairness, for their sourcing. And these ratings were clearly given by users with faces and names. And it was this community of people who were reading the news here, and they were commenting, and they were helping filter the news for journalistic qualities. I started rating stories, and the minimum action was just doing these 1 through 5 ratings of each story. But this, it was a very well-engineered application, so that if you contributed more, you got more privileges, and eventually you became a moderator, basically, and you were able to moderate the queue of stories that had been sucked in by RSS that had not been entered into the system yet. And my activity on NewsTrust got noticed by the director of the, I don't remember what his title was, and they kept hiring me on contract to do these like big lifts of just basically manual labor of like vetting new news sources to add. And eventually I was hired as a contractor for a long time, and then as a salaried employee to work for this site. And that involved some blogging, some kind of campaigns that we would do for certain kinds of news. So these were the first blog posts that I wrote on like a company blog that got pretty wide circulation. And before you knew it, I was involved in the online news media world through this very funny, weird little nonprofit company. And I was living in Portland, Oregon at the time. After I left Providence, I moved to Portland, Oregon. And that's where Marshall Kirkpatrick from Read Write Web lived, and where Abraham Hyatt, the managing editor at the time at Read Write Web, lived. And they were all at these local journalist things that I was going to. And because I was at kind of a techie company, I was also keeping my eye on the tech aspect of the online media ecosystem. And that was enough to get me a contract as a writer at ReadWriteWeb. And I faked it till I made it as a tech reporter and was able to learn the beats quickly enough to actually become full-time doing that. And then writing every day and covering my beats, reporting on the tech companies. I'd sort of moved to the other side of the coin. I was still very interested in media, but I was writing about the companies who were more clearly every day controlling the pipelines of media and the parameters of creating and publishing. I skipped the part where I joined Twitter, which I guess was also in 09. It was the year. And now we're basically at the point where you and I met online.
And how long were you working for ReadWriteWeb?
I guess my first contract was in 2011, and I left at some point in 2013. It was only a couple of years. I can't believe that it was only a couple of years. It felt like ages and ages.
Felt like a lot longer than that.
Well, yeah, because so much happened. The world changed dramatically in that period of time. It was kind of perfect timing, really.
Yeah.
In the scope of ReadWriteWeb's history, I came in at the end of the beginning.
Mm.
I came in at the very, very tail end of it being Richard McManus's blog still, but he was making so much money on ads that he was able to pay like 8 or 10 of us to write. And there were a couple of other non-writer jobs, basically like accountants and lawyers and stuff. I was too young and inexperienced at the time to realize that what they were doing was looking for an acquisition, packaging up the site to be sold. So that happened like a year in. And that was what brought me to San Francisco from Portland to work full-time at an online media company with a sales team and an engineering department. And I forgot to mention that we had developers on payroll at ReadWriteWeb too, but now we had an engineering team and a design team and all that stuff. But we had a parent company and all that entailed. And sibling sites. And
yeah, that sounds a lot different.
It couldn't have been more different from blogging, which it really still was at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately upon the acquisition, it all changed. I mean, that whole concept of blog networks with shared traffic and cross promotion and shared ad deals. And, you know, suddenly we're the tech nerd part of the portfolio, and the people at the table next to us are the cats and dogs website. And that really changed the meaning of it.
Yeah.
But, and that's, I mean, like, I can fast forward through the rest of the story, basically. Like, I burned out of that as the internet got worse and worse. The end. Here we are.
Yeah.
I mean, that was 5 years ago. But
that's been the last 5 years.
I've done some other stuff in my career since then. But yeah, the last 5 years has really been kind of figuring out what to do with the internet after all of that.
So it was news first and tech second for you. I didn't really know that.
Well, as a focus of my career, that's true. But the love of computers,
right,
was what got me out on the internet in the first place. And the web as a technology or as a collection of technologies was the thing that drove my curiosity. You know, I wouldn't have gotten into the news business if not for blogs and RSS, which was essentially a nerd pursuit for me.
Well, how did you even learn about RSS and that kind of thing?
That's a really good question. I mean, I don't remember how I encountered Google Reader or something like that, but it was all part of the same ecosystem. I mean, you know, it was probably somebody's blog that had that orange button on it with the RSS logo, and I clicked on that and it said subscribe by Google Reader, and I said, okay, that seems like an easy enough thing to do.
Yeah, that's true. I guess that in the first place, before there was the kind of hooks for RSS and everything, you just visited all the sites.
Yeah.
And probably one of those sites advised you to go to Google Reader, and then you realized that kind of made sense, because at that time, it sure did.
Yeah. It was either that, or it was, at the time, the Mail app on the Mac had an RSS reader in it, I think. There were times when that was the case and times when it was in the browser, and I can't remember which was the case. But Google Reader was definitely the service that I used. And I'm sure I found it in a button on a sidebar of a blog.
Which, doesn't that seem novel at this point? Can you imagine finding like a huge new service that you're going to devote all your time to as an aside to something that you're reading these days? That just seems so wild to me.
No, most of the services I discover in the sidebar of things I'm reading these days are horrible things that I want nothing to do with.
Right, that's what I mean. Totally, it's a very different time. I feel like I used to find new apps all the time too, and that just never happens anymore. You know, it feels very strange to think about finding something new that I'm going to integrate into my daily use just on a whim. It would be a much bigger deal than that.
I'm sure this is going to be a theme for us, but some of the patterns feel like they are settled to me, or mostly settled. The usages and this usage patterns and behaviors of how this stuff should work. Some of it feels like it's settling. I mean, I'm still using Instapaper. I don't remember at what point I got Instapaper in that whole long story I just told, but it was way at the beginning and I'm still using it. You know, that was what we were talking about the day we met on that show.
Yeah.
So that model feels like it will, as long as we're reading text, you know, which God willing will be forever, that sort of seems like it's a solved problem for me. Although if things weren't on the web anymore, I wouldn't be able to get stuff in there. And then I don't know what to do. So some of these patterns are settled. And then others, I feel like we have shed. We were willing to try so many more different ways to use these devices at one point.
It's weird to think back on the how did you get on the internet type story. And mine always feels very juvenile, but I guess kind of everyone's story is a little juvenile, right? I mean, when you're a teenager and that's when the web is starting to proliferate, you find weird ways to get on it just because that's something to do. And I feel like there's probably a lot of people's stories who are like that. We just never really talk about them because it'd be weird to talk about them all the time, I guess. I was kind of the same as you. I've always loved computers. I had a lot of just interactions with them growing up, both in my house. I have a very distinct memory of going to a computer store and buying a Compaq Presario and bringing that home in, who knows, 97, 98, 96, something along those lines, and just figuring it out, you know, figuring out what to do with a computer that felt like mine and didn't have a whole lot of stuff to do on the internet at that time, but I definitely became more and more adept at using the computer just because I had it. I liked video games growing up, and I never was like a huge gamer, but I liked them enough that I ended up getting a subscription to a magazine called Electronic Gaming Monthly, which probably still exists in some weird form. You know, who knows how magazines are doing these days, but it was called EGM. And I remember them promoting their website that had a message board on it. And me being bored one day and not having a lot to do and just signing up for the message board. And that was really my first huge social connection online. And I was probably on that message board for years. I have no idea how long, but for years and years, and started having honest to God friendships with people online that I had never really anticipated having. And this was, you know, back on web forum message board days where no one knew each other's real name. I never knew really anybody's name except for the username that they had. And sometimes we'd play games together online, which is a really weird thing to think that I was doing that on a dial-up modem because, you know, that was that time period, right? But I remember having a PlayStation 2 and getting this weird little peripheral for it that let me hook up a wired connection to it and playing a game called SOCOM with these people that I had started meeting on this internet forum. And then conversations moved from the internet forum to AIM.
Yes.
And man, remember AIM? You know, what a weird thing to think back to.
I don't want to interrupt your story, but I just had that whole, I left the whole like chat part of being online completely out of my story, I just realized.
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, it was the same, basically. Like, I don't have to tell the whole story because you just told it. Like, there was musicianforums.net or something. And I, you know, that was the first place where I talked to random people online. And that was in high school.
Right.
Probably around the same time as the whole first blog thing. But yes, of course, AIM. And I was using that certainly into college to keep in touch with people from high school. That was the first time where people who were friends in real life who we talked to after school on AIM, we were able to maintain that kind of relationship that we had with them, only the virtual part, like after going off to college. And the screen names were the same and, you know, the font settings were the same. That was the first time that a relationship moved online for me.
Yeah. And even just for the summer or that kind of thing. I had a couple of friends who the summer would come in and they would go somewhere else. They'd go visit a relative.
Yeah.
And usually that would have been the end of our friendship until the next time that we saw each other, or maybe, you know, full stop, that would have been the end. And instead, I would continue talking with them. I feel like we see movies pretty often that are doing the trope of the 50s, 60s, 70s, and, you know, the whole house has just one phone line, and the kids are taking it up by being on the phone with their boyfriend or girlfriend late at night. And I haven't really seen that for our generation yet, but I'm assuming that'll come sooner or later, of the angry parents who are mad that whenever they pick up their phone line, they just hear the weird noises because the internet modem is up and spinning.
The modem sounds, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so I have very distinct memories of taking up that phone line for long hours and talking to friends. And I never had that many online relationships at that time, partially because it seemed weird if you didn't know the people online. Because like I said, I never knew really anybody's real name to begin with. And it was very discouraged. I don't know if you felt that way or not, but no one ever told me, don't put your real name online. But it was just this kind of in the ether concept that you were supposed to maintain some amount of anonymity when you went online and talked to people there.
Yep, absolutely. I don't know where I learned it either, but I did the same exact thing.
It just felt like the thing to do. Yeah, and you know, no one, how weird would it have been at that time to go to that music forum,
yeah,
and sign up with your real name? You know, I'm sure that, did you have a username or something like that? I'm assuming that you did.
Well, my username was just John M, but people only referred to each other as their username.
Yeah, exactly.
My name was J-O-N-M, as far as anyone was concerned.
And I'm sure that if there are people that you made fond memories with that you don't talk to anymore, when they think of you, they think of you as John M.
Yeah.
Not as John, you know, or John Mitchell, because that was your handle. And I had those relationships for so long. And thinking back, you know, it's so fuzzy. I have no idea what we talked about. Those message logs are long, long gone. I wish that there was a record of them somewhere. Well, maybe I don't wish there was a record of them because I was young.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I would be very happy with the things that I was spending time talking about. Which, again, that's a funny thing, right? Is how much is that even a good thing that technology is going to bring about? You know, the recording of every word for us to look back at later. I don't know if I really want that or not.
I don't even feel good about my tweets from the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of weird to think that that is becoming more and more normal, and those words, yeah, will become more and more permanent as we have services that actually keep them around.
Yeah, I guess my tweets are gone.
Yeah, your tweets are gone, but iMessage in the cloud,
yeah,
will be coming to your phone sometime soon, so those messages will be sticking around longer than your next reboot.
Messages are different. I feel like the new paradigm of messages, where it feels one-to-one and there's, you know, at least enough encryption involved that, like, if your Apple ID were to be closed, I don't think you could get into those messages anymore. It feels like it's mine now.
That's true.
I treat the logs of my messages these days as kind of like those are the safe places. Whereas there was no concept of that in the AIM chat room days. And I'm like terrified to know what kinds of stuff ended up on AOL servers that got acquired dozens of times and are now probably in the hands of the North Korean Secret Service or something.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I had never thought about that. I felt like when my compact Presario got junked, those things were gone forever. But you are very right, aren't you?
Yeah.
Those are definitely somewhere,
yeah,
just not in my possession. That's really weird. That really was, for me, the thing that I did online. And the message board that I was a part of transitioned to another message board. You know, people kind of moved around from place to place. And I started watching MySpace exist, Facebook exist. And then Twitter, when that kind of came on the scene and started getting bigger and bigger, that became something that I was really fascinated by. I never talked about video games on this video game forum to begin with. So it didn't really matter to me where that community existed. And I had been doing a little writing at that time. So I ended up starting a blog on Blogspot where I just wrote some stuff about art that was impacting me. So if I found a song that I really liked, I would write a little thing about the song. If I found a movie I really liked, I would write a little thing about the movie. And I didn't publish them anywhere. I wouldn't have even known how to do that at that time. Because of the way that I spent my time, I never really got that deeply embedded in the internet, the world of the internet, until I had an iPhone in my hand. And of course, that ability to have that was such a profound difference. Mm-hmm. And I had used it before, but it just sucked, right? Like I had a T-Mobile Sidekick years before the iPhone came out because I loved the idea of having the internet in the palm of my hand. But really what that meant was I had a very slow Google connection in the palm of my hand. That was really all that it was good for. But still, that was incredible and revolutionary for the time.
Yeah.
I remember sitting at a diner with a friend and them asking, is Splenda actually good for you? And me saying, oh, well, let me find out, and pulling out my phone and Googling that question. And that was like a weird thing to be able to do, because there was that time period where you asked questions out loud and you didn't expect to get the answer immediately. Although that doesn't really work that way anymore.
I also had an internet-connected phone before smartphones, and I went back. I had some weird Samsung phone that had a tiny screen that had a rudimentary web browser and email on it. And when I got to college, I needed a new phone, and I was like, I don't need that crap. I just want a phone again.
I didn't learn my lesson. I ended up getting some weird Windows mobile phone, fighting it all the time. I remember spending a lot of time on XDA, some developer forums where you could download like custom ROMs for your phone to make them run 2% faster and do a few things differently. And yeah, all that kind of crazy stuff.
Well, this is way, way above my level.
Yeah, but I never really enjoyed those until the iPhone existed. And I feel like in a weird way, I never really enjoyed a lot of the internet or the social parts of the internet until I had that too. It also really made me more creative.
Yeah.
I think that when there was something about the way that I felt about the internet when I was sitting in front of a desktop computer or even a laptop that made me feel like I wasn't really supposed to contribute. And I don't know why I felt that way, but I did. It didn't feel like something that I had a lot of control over. And that's kind of the funny thing, right? Is as like technology progressed and people got iPhones and iPads, people said, oh, these things, they're consumption devices. But for me, I mean, that was what unlocked me to feel like I was a creative. One of the things that really, really felt that way was having the bad old iPhone camera, but just having a camera with me at all times made me take so many photos. And I had a little community of friends. We all hung out together all the time. And I started a Tumblr that was dedicated to just me posting photos of our community. And it's still online today. You know, one of the weird little miracles of something that's existed for that long. Because the camera was so bad, I would just convert all the photos to black and white because I felt like that made them look a little nicer. And all of our friends would go on that Tumblr and just look at the pictures. Mm-hmm. And it's a really weird snapshot in time for me of a way that I was using the internet to try and capture something and create something and share something at the same time, before that was really a thing that you could do extremely easily. And then with Twitter for me felt like the thing that I had been looking for a long time.
Before you moved to Twitter, I want to know when you started taking pictures, period, and whether that was already something you were doing when that capability to do it online entered your hand.
I've kind of dabbled as a photographer for a long time. And that actually came up because I have a friend who lived as a missionary in Guatemala. And he lived there for 8 years. He actually just came back last week to the States. He's been there for that entire time. 8 years ago, I remember he took a trip out and I went with him. And I took a little Nikon Coolpix camera and came back and thought, wow, these photos do not at all represent what I saw. And then the next time that we went back a year later, about a week before we left, I impulsively bought a Canon Rebel and basically learned how to take photos while I was in Guatemala with him, because I just wanted so desperately to show people what he was doing and who he was working with. And I really wanted a way to try and bring that out. Actually, this is interesting. I had never really connected it, but I do have a very distinct memory of buying that Nikon Coolpix and trying to take good photos with it. And then wondering, well, now that I have this photo, what am I supposed to do with it? And feeling like Flickr probably existed and I probably uploaded some to Flickr, but that never really felt right because who cares? Like no one did anything with Flickr. That wasn't a platform. And I found some weird blogging platform that was specifically catered to photos, but it wasn't really social. It wasn't really that great. I think I made a couple of little like posts on that thing and then abandoned it quickly. And weirdly enough, I mean, I'm still worrying about that problem all this time later. You know, I've upgraded my camera, but I haven't really upgraded my what do I do with this thing now feeling. I mean, the answer is much more obvious today, or it's supposed to be at least. The answer should be Instagram, but that is not really what I want to do with my photos. So, you know, this is a challenge that's been ongoing for a decade.
Yeah, the what is Instagram, the why is completely unanswered.
Yeah. the kind of final part of that is, and then I found Twitter, and Twitter was the thing that I'd always been looking for because I just wanted a place to talk with people who were like-minded.
Yeah.
And you could do that on Twitter. My interest in video games had at that point evolved to an interest in technology, and I became part of Tech Twitter. And I liked that because it felt very much similar to the message boards that didn't exist anymore. They still existed, but no one was there anymore. People had just moved on from that model. And I found a new feeling of that kind of community on Twitter. And I mean, man, I think it's probably been about 9 years, 9 or 10 years that I've been on Twitter. And I still am. But somewhere along the way, it just hasn't been the same. And I mean, blogging and tweeting became the two primary functions of what I did online and kind of continues to be the primary things of what I do online. But I mean, I think like you, somewhere along the way, every interaction with online has felt a bit devoid of the meaning and the joy that it had.
There are so many things that we have in parallel with each other. One big difference that jumps out to me from the two accounts that we just gave is that you came gradually to the idea of contributing.
Right.
Whereas that was the first thing that occurred to me to do with it. So much of the decline for me was about losing a kind of validation that I had been getting. That for the good years, I felt like I was getting positive feedback for my contributions, and that was what kept me riding high. And that started to go away, and that going away and the loss that I felt with that going away also corresponded with a maturation process that probably should have happened before any of this, where I started to realize that being out there too was what mattered to me. Whereas gradually the importance of mostly learning and then occasionally speaking started to sink in. And along with that, the kind of deeper thing of wanting to live a life where I didn't feel like I needed that kind of external source of validation to feel whole anymore, which is a very heavy way of putting it, but that's how serious it was for me when the internet started to go bad. And I've had much more public kind of fits about it maybe than you have, like writing whole books about it and stuff. and like deleting my accounts and making a big deal about it, which you also haven't done yet, I say. So sure that you said they will.
Yeah, I see that you're setting me up. Yeah.
It sounds maybe like the loss of the community part was hard enough for you, but does any of that stuff about the validation resonate for you?
I mean, yes and no. Maybe the way that I can say it is that when Twitter became a thing, that felt like the thing that had obviously needed to exist for a long time, and I was really excited that I now had that tool. And it felt for a little while like the internet and technology was going to continue providing me with tools, more and more of them, that were going to get better and better. And I was shocked to find out that somewhere along the way, not only did the tools stop getting better, but they stopped coming and they started getting worse.
Yeah.
And that was a weird problem that I don't think I had thought would happen. And when I said, oh man, I don't know where to share these photos, there was a part of me that was positive that someone was working on that and that was going to get figured out real quick and then there would be a great place for me to put them. But instead of me finding a place to put them, I actually feel like there's less places to put them than ever. Flickr was never great, but now why would you possibly put something on Flickr?
Some people thought it was.
It never felt like it got pushed into the new area of technology. It felt like the web 1.5. where Twitter and Tumblr felt like the web 2.0.
I think also the thing that cut Flickr down at the knees was Facebook. Flickr could have become Facebook, but when Facebook started making photo albums and tagging,
right,
all of the potential for that went away for Flickr. They just didn't see it coming.
A problem started occurring when these things that were very good ended up being not very profitable. And that actually started to mean that things needed to change.
Yeah.
And that happened to Twitter, that happened to Flickr, that happened to basically everything that I used. And I started getting worried about where I could put the things that I cared about and that I created. Even in writing, that was true. Mm-hmm. I started my blog on WordPress, But I never really liked it. I never really enjoyed using WordPress. I found it very clunky. And whenever there's like a lot of clunky stuff to do on the back end, that makes me very unenthusiastic about doing stuff that is creative and interesting. Mm-hmm. And then Medium came onto the scene and I thought, oh, that's awesome. That's actually exactly what I'm looking for. And I moved it over there and it still is there, my blog. And I still like it okay. But if I had to tell you that I'm confident that Medium will be around for the next 5 years, you know, right? Like, I'm not sure if I could do that. So do I feel great about writing and contributing to a platform that I'm not positive will exist for long or has like a business model that can sustain itself or cares about me as a customer? They don't even allow you to do what I did, which is create a custom URL. I think that you have to have a soandso.medium.com these days. You couldn't have a custom URL Medium.
You can't do custom domains anymore on Medium?
Yeah, I think that they got rid of that feature about 6 months ago.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, how great do I feel about working on a project?
Oh, what a sign that is.
Exactly, right? And the thing is that those signs are everywhere on every platform. And that makes me feel dejected when I want to do something creative.
Yeah.
Because, hey, these tools are the very things that made me feel like I was a competent creative to begin with. And if those tools don't have a path forward, well, then I don't know what my path forward looks like as somebody who wants to do creative things online. And that's true for writing. That's true for communicating, just like on a social level. That's true for music. That's true for video. You know, no creative act is escaping this problem online. And it's something that I feel like no one is ever really talking about. And that blows my mind because it's the thing that matters more than anything else, right?
I don't know if it matters more than anything else. The internet has managed to entangle in a way that is interesting because it draws out humanity to be creative together in a way that nothing ever has before. And that's because we can create for each other instead of creating in a vacuum. And the thing that made all of these online platforms meaningful and continues to make them meaningful is that we can make things for each other and encourage each other onward. And the community that forms around that activity, to me, is the most important thing. That's why I hope it can span whatever place, whatever virtual place. I mean, that's the thing. The placeness of online places is so vague of a suggestion that you and I, for example, are able to make the jump to other places to continue having the conversation. And that's the antidote to lock in and to the walled garden problem and to Medium taking custom domains off their service so that everybody has to go to Medium in order to find anything. The relationships that are formed around this creation of new culture for each other has to be something that can escape these unfortunate corporate containers that are built for housing this stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the thing, right? Is like Twitter is our version of the town square. It's become a weirdly important embedded platform that people go to say things that are important and critical because it has to be something that's done on a global level and not a local level anymore. And so what happens when the places that exist where the entire community is aren't good anymore? Like, that's what I'm saying. You know, I don't know what to do at that point.
Yeah, and maybe we're saying the same thing in different ways, but the thing that is lost when that happens is that the square becomes trashed and no one wants to hang out there anymore.
Right.
Or people are still there because they have to be there, but they're in a bad mood about it and their behavior changes. And that is really dangerous potential for these services that have monopolized this kind of technology. They've got the network effects so nailed down that we're hostage to them. And of course, I've rejected that idea by shutting down my Facebook and Twitter accounts, but it remains to be seen whether I'm still connected to the world. You know, that's one of the things that I'm interested to figure out. And if I'm not, I don't know what I'm going to do. I think my relationships are fine. Like, I still have really good relationships that are not in LA with me, mm-hmm. you know, that I'm maintaining through various kinds of messages and calls and stuff. And I'm not worried about that anymore. That was the thing that really kept me on Facebook, was I'm worried I'm not going to have friends anymore. But that was obviously false. The idea that it's the town square, though, that makes it something more fundamental to society. If it's really the town square, then it means it's a civic space that has to exist. It may not have had to exist in the first place, but now that it does exist, like, civic life has to take place there because that's where everyone is. And if that's impossible, that's really dangerous. And I guess that's what we're seeing. That's what we're seeing every day as more and more news comes out about how just completely owned the social media companies were by nefarious foreign intelligence agencies. That's evidence that you're right, that it is like a civic necessity that these places be healthy.
And they're not.
But you and I clearly are searching for healthy civic life online. And you have visions in your mind about what you want to see. Like when you found Twitter, you said this should have always been here.
Yeah.
It seems like you still have that vision, however vaguely defined it may be, in your mind's eye. And I don't, but I'm open to it. I want to find it again.
I've been thinking about this quote a lot. I recently read this book called The Futilitarians, and it was this memoir by this woman who had kind of gone through like a dark night of the soul period of her life. She was from a big family, and actually like two of her sisters, one after the other in a period of maybe 6 months to a year, killed themselves. And it was this really tragic, horrible thing that she had suffered through. And she was a writer. And I talked with her father about that experience, and her father asked her to never write about that and not bring this very private and intensely painful thing into the public space. And she had said something along the lines of realizing how unfair that had been, because this person who had raised her to be a writer, to think critically and question what was going on around her, had in that moment demanded that she shut herself off creatively from this really profound and horrible experience, one of the most horrible experiences of her life. She recognized that he hadn't stopped her from writing, he had just stopped her from sharing, and she said that an author friend of hers had described that process as chewing and not swallowing. I felt a resonance with that concept of there's something at least inside of me that when I want to create something, what I'm really saying is I want to share something creative. And when I want to say something, often that means that I want to share something that I have to say. And there's a very important part of any process that is me making something that ends in sharing. And when we don't have places to share, and when the places that even empowered us to share start to disempower that sharing or prioritize another kind of sharing or stop caring about what is being shared, that's a huge problem. And now what? Because I want to have a full meal. I don't want to have this feeling of an empty stomach, even though I have a lot in front of me. And I think that's where we are, is we're all famished. Even though there's more content than ever, you know, how much we love the word content. Why am I so hungry? And why are so many people that I know so hungry? And if that's true, and it's not just an experience that I'm having, but that many, many, many other people are feeling right along with me, then what can we do about it? And that's what I want to know.